Yoshua, Perchav Dalid. All right, we're starting. Yoshua, Perchav Dalid. Yeah, right in the beginning. Right in the beginning. It says, "Vayasuk Yoshua's kol shivti Yisrael." Shchama, he gathered all b'nei Yisrael. The Shchem, Vayikrael zikni Yisrael, LaRashav, LaShofta, LaShotra, VeYisatzvu lifnei Elokim. He called us the Zekanim, the heads of each nation, the Shoftim, as well as the Shotrim, the officers as well, and they all stood in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Now it's weird because he had just called them together last parak. In Perchav Gimel, he just said, "All right, guys, come together. I want to tell you a message." So what's happening this time? So there are four different opinions over here. One opinion is the first was on his own initiative. Now HaKadosh Baruch Hu said you have to gather them together. A spirit of Nevuah came upon him and said you have to go tell them exactly what I want. And they all stood before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the idea behind it. So that's the first opinion. Second opinion is that he knew what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted. And he knew that the first time he had spoken to people and he wanted them to say certain things and they hadn't said it. So this time, instead of gathering all of the people, he gathered the Shoftim, the Shotrim, the leaders of the nation, and he told them, all right, guys, this is what I'm looking for. I want you guys to agree to something so that you know exactly what I'm looking for.
The wording is weird, though. It's kol shivtei Yisrael.
You're right, but he called out to Ziknei Yisrael,
right, so
Rosh
Hashanah. So he gathered everybody together? And then he singled people out
in front to tell them this message. Right. This message.
But everybody was there.
Correct. But it could be everybody was around, but they wouldn't be able to hear him because obviously his voice wouldn't be able to carry that far. Number three was the first time he called them to give them muster. The second time is to make a brand new bris with them. Right? That's the idea behind it. And also, the fourth answer is, look, he's following the example of what Moshe Rabbeinu did. Moshe called them in the first Shvat. And then right before his death, on Yud Gimel, on Zayin Adar, right before then he called them a second time, right? Vayilich Moshe, etc., right? So therefore, it's like what he did the first time around. He's doing what Moshe Rabbeinu did over here. Now, the reason why Shechem, why in Shechem over any other place? The first answer is simply put, it's close to home. He was from Shevet Ephraim, and this is right by Shevet Ephraim. Another reason is because that's where Har Gerizim and Har Ebal were, right? This is also where the Shvatim did Tshuva for what they had done in Shechem when they had sold Yosef Atzadik, also because Yaakov owned it, so it actually was owned by Yaakovino itself. There were big Nisim that happened in that area. Remember, they were outnumbered by the enemies, you know, the people who were friends with Shechem, and there was a whole Melchames B'nei Yaakov that happened. There was a big Nesa that happened over there. Number six, it might be that Shechem wasn't owned by a Shevet, because Shechem, if you remember, was an Ir Miklat, right? And it was the middle Ir Miklat, so the perfect place to go. It is in Yosef's territory, but it was an Ir Miklat, which means it technically was not owned by anybody, although the city, everything around it was conquered by Yosef, by Menashe, and everybody had it, Ephraim, I believe. And then number seven, because Kadosh Baruch Hu simply told them to go to Shechem. So therefore, they all went to Shechem, and that's that. Pasuk Beis, Vayomer Yoshua kol ha'am, kol ha'amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, be'evar ha'nar, Yoshua v'sechem me'olam, terech avi Avram, avi Nachor, v'yavdol lehim acherim. So Yoshua said to the people and said, this is what Kadosh Baruch Hu says. On the other side of the Jordan River, right, your fathers always lived. There was Terach, the father of Avram, and the father of Nachor. Interesting that he doesn't mention the father of Haran. And they served other gods. And I took your father, Avram Avinu, from the other side of that river. I brought him through the land of Canaan. The Arba Ezaro, and I gave him many children. No, Haran would be because of Sarah.
Right, but that's because of a midrash, the Vizka. That's only, but say, but Haran was the, or Mizar Nachor was the ancestor of Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Sarah, you have to resort to a midrash to say that she's
Yiska. That's an interesting call. I never thought of that. That's an interesting call. Haran is never mentioned specifically the father of Sarah. No, not at all?
It does say
I mean, he's got that one pasuk says that. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you have enough midrashim out there.
But
you're right. It's midrashim. It's
his
not
father, Avram's father.
Like, yeah, you know, I just don't know. You're right. That sounds amazing. That sounds absolutely amazing. Anyway, we have over here, if you don't recognize these psukim, it's because it's not Pesach yet. It's going to be Pesach in another couple weeks. We do say these in the Haggadah itself. Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Haya Avoseinu, right? That our fathers were Ovdei Avodah Zarah. The idea behind it is, up until the time when Avraham Avinu was in, you know, when he was 3 years old, up until however long, right? Avraham Avinu, until he came to Eretz Canaan, 70, 75, however old he was, Avraham Avinu was persecuted for his beliefs and his beliefs in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We all know what happened with, you know, the Orkastim. According to Rambam, he was also thrown in jail for 13 years, right, in Kutia, where he was hiding for 13 years away from Nimrod. We have no idea what was really happening there because we don't have any stories about it. There's nothing in the Torah about it. But when he came to Eretz Yisrael, he was protected. So that once he came through the Eretz Canaan, it was a totally different story. And we see that his life was totally different. In the other areas, he was proselytizing, going out and making people. Here, he stood in a tent, and he sat in a tent, and he let people come to him. It was a different style of what he was doing over here. That was very, very different over here. It was also, it's not Menachas Chiyosov when he went through over here, but that was Avram itself. It's weird that it says Va'arbe, right? But it reads as Va'ariv, as if I fought with his children when I go through over here. It could be that this refers to the machlokis in between Yitzchak and the other children with Yishmael and the children of Keturah. They didn't follow in Avram's footsteps and they didn't go through here. So maybe it refers to there was an actual riv about what was going to happen.
Did the other children have a chance?
I'm sorry?
Did the other children have a chance?
I think so, because all of us knew it.
Yeah, but Esav, you can make an argument he came from Rivka, but yeah. Yitzchak's the only one that came from Sarah. And all the
promises definitely hear
made
you.
To Abraham were from
I definitely hear you, but if you. They were born after Sari Menu died and didn't have a chance, and Keturah was as special as the Medrash says she was, right, that she was Makter Maaseihan,
all the Pesukim's promises, and everything, I'm giving everything to Yitzchak, and God says, I'm going to give you a son from Sarah. And
yeah, it could be, I don't know, but it seems definitely they had a chance to say they didn't have a chance. I think they had a chance.
That means they have a chance. They had a chance to, you know, to be upstanding individuals, but I'm telling what to be a forefather of the Jewish people.
Maybe. Yeah, it could have been. It could have been. If they would have been good enough, then maybe, yeah. We know that Yitzchak was awesome, and maybe this through the tefillahs of Sari Menu, but we don't know. I mean, look, they started great nations. The Arab nation is still an awesome nation, even if it's weird. And if the B'nai Keturah went out east, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, I know. But if they went out east, who knows? Like, if they went out east and they started India, China, etc., if they are the starters then, that was B'nai Avram, B'nai Keturah, right? Then we see the greatness in them, but unfortunately they didn't do it in the right way. I don't know. It's an interesting call. Either way, Etan Yitzchak is Yaakov Esav, Etan Esav is Har Seir, L'Resh Yosef Yaakov Vanam Yardim Mitzrayim. So I give Yitzchak Yaakov and Esav. And then there was a choice. Esav was given Har Seir for her to inherit. Yaakov and his children, they went down to Mitzrayim. The choice was given. If you want to go and inherit Eretz Yisrael, then you have to go through Golos. If you're willing to go through Golos and take the travails and the Yisurin that you're supposed to have, then eventually you'll get there, right? They were both. It's interesting because Yaakov and Esav obviously were given the exact same background, exact same parents, exact same everything, except Yaakov came out one way and Esav came out the exact other, right? By accepting Har Seir, he gave up all rights to the Bris of Avraham, who he no longer was going to have it. He gave up the rights to what the Torah stands for and everything like that. He had a chance later on to take the Torah, but no. V'ashach is Moshe Ves Aaron. Now, this is interesting. In the Haggadah, we skip this pasuk because we don't want to mention Moshe and Aaron. But I sent Moshe and Aaron by Egofis Mitzrayim, and I plagued Mitzrayim because Rasisi Bikirav, and afterward I took you out. You came to the Yamsuf, and the Mitzrayim chased after your fathers, but Rechavah for Roshim by Yamsuf, with chariots and horsemen all the way to the Yamsuf. They cried out to Hashem, and made a darkness between you and Mitzrayim and between the Egyptians. That's where we have the idea of the Choshech, although it was the Anan that went behind, but we see that it was a ma'afel, something that became darkness. The makkah of Choshech came back. He brought a sea upon them and covered them. You saw with your own eyes what I did in Mitzrayim. You lived in the desert many years. I don't know how many people were still alive from those people that were there, because remember, the 600,000 Jews that had left Mitzrayim along with Yoshua, they were all dead because of the Meraglim. Right? You had women, there were definitely women alive, and there were older men, people who were older than 60 who maybe didn't die by this time, but they would have been 100 by now. The kids under 20, sure, some of them would have remembered it. I don't know, it's been 40 years. I don't know how many of these people we can honestly say you saw it with your own eyes. It's slowly but surely, right? We're dealing with children, grandchildren, and stuff like that. It's people like that. Perhaps, though, it's referring to the children that were miraculously saved. There were some awesome miracles that happened at this time. The children that were, you know, taken out of the earth, out of the river, they were revived. The wording of, what is it, Kitzemach HaSodeh, like the sprouts of the field, they came out, etc. We don't know. It's a very, very strange thing altogether.
Same thing's happening now with the Shoah.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, 100%. We're looking at it like, you have no idea. We have absolutely no idea. Absolutely no shaychus. It's hard to even imagine. Pasuk Ches. V'aviyaschem el Eretz Amorim. I brought you to the land of the Moriah Yosha, very, very on the other side of the Jordan River. Yilachmo itchem. They wage war with you. Atino sam b'yedchem. And I put them in your hands. V'atirshu esartam. You drove out them from their lands. V'ashirim ibnechem. And I destroyed them from in front of you. Interestingly, he's calling the Amori. the Amori specifically, and not the Canaanim, etc., and all the other nations out there. It could be the Amori was the most powerful of them. It could be that Sihon and Og were technically Amorites, and therefore that was the idea. They started with those. I don't know. Vayakam Balak ben Tzippor, Melech Moav, Yilachem Yisrael. Balak ben Tzippor got up. He waged war against the Jews, the king of Moav. Yishlach v'yikor leVilam ben Baor lekalaschem. He sent and called out to Bilam ben Baor to curse you. V'lov yisi lishmo leBilam. But I didn't want to listen to Bilam. Vayvarach boruch eschem. And instead he gave you a bracha v'atzil eschem miyadoi. And I saved you from his hands over here. So it's interesting over here, once again. So again, if you look at the word va'avi, again, there's a hey at the end of it, but you read it as va'avi. So the extra hey is feminine to tell you that the Shekhinah never left them. It was with them the whole time, so it's feminine, so to speak, as if the Shekhinah is feminine as well, as if to say. And that's the idea behind what he ended up giving. So I gave you that land of the Amori. And it's likely referring to the land of Og and Sihon, because if Balak and Bilam came afterward, then it's likely it was after they had already destroyed Sihon and Og. It's clear, Balak ben Tzippor, right, was the Kosem, as opposed to Bilam, who was an astrologer and a curser. Balak was involved with this Tzippor. Now, the Yalkut Ruveni brings down this unbelievable medrash that the Tzippor was a bird that he had created out of different metals and hashpos, different types of names of shadim, etc. And the bird was somehow able to go to this place called Galui Einayim, which we call the Mountains of Darkness, the Hare Choshech, to meet up with Azoel and Shamchaza, these two massive demons that live in this area, Malachi demons that were out there. But there was some type of idea of magic, and Balak knew that his magic wouldn't be strong enough to be able to survive there. He knew he needed somebody like Bilam. Bilam was an unbelievable astrologer. He was able to tell the future, and not only tell the future, but he was also able to curse based on the future. He was able to see things that were so clear, he was able to make sure that he could curse right at the right time. Balak realized that true greatness that Bilam had, and therefore wanted him not only to curse, but to really see what was going on here. There were 10 curses that Bilam did, and they turned into brachos. Tavrus Yarden, but you crossed over the Jordan River. Batavol Yericho, you came to Yericho, but Yelachim, you waged war, the people of Yericho, and as well as the Amori, Prizi, Kanani, Chiti, Girgashi, Chivi, Yavusi, those were the seven nations, and I put them into your hands themselves. Now that's a little weird, because think about it. The people of Yericho fought with Bnei Yisrael. There was no real battle there. After the walls came down, it seemed like the people of Yericho just put down their arms and were like, we can't do anything. That's what it sounds like over here. So what does it mean over here? It could be referring to the war of the kings that they had right afterward, that they fought against all those kings, the five kings and the whatever it is, right afterward, because the kings and their followers identified with the people of Yericho, and they fought against Bnei Yisrael as if they were people from Yericho themselves. It could be that in Yericho they actually did fight. It just doesn't seem that way from the Pasuk. The Pesukim seem to say that they just walked
Yericho,
in.
Meaning the owners of Yericho. Mm-hmm. Was it a vassal state by any chance? And then once
there was a king. We know there was a melech of Yericho.
Right, but that could have been a vassal to another king nearby, and once they attacked Yericho, the other people came along and said, hey, this is ours.
So there are two answers that way. Number one is that Yericho was supposedly a very beautiful land, right? That was the area where Ir HaTamarim, they called it. So it could be that many, many areas had like a vacation home in Yericho, which make a lot of sense within the context of what Rachav Azona was doing the entire time. That is one way of looking at it. Number two, the Canaanim considered Yericho their land because it was the major defense. It was the that was the city you met when you crossed over the Jordan River. So unless you had to cross the Yam HaMelech or the Kinneret, which armies couldn't do back then. You had to go all the way up north or south. So the way they would do is they'd ford the Jordan River. The first city you met up with was the big city of Yericho. That's there. Anyway, v'ashach lipnechem es hatzir. I sent out in front of you the hornets. And they drove out the people from you. It wasn't your sword, it wasn't your bow. I gave you a land that you did not work for. Cities you did not build. You had vineyards, you had olive groves that you did not plant, and you just ate them over here. Now the wasps are definitely strange over here. Some say that it doesn't mean Sira, as in that it means Tsaras, that the people at Tsaras, the Canaanim ended up getting Tsaras, and they couldn't fight and they couldn't do anything whatsoever. That's definitely a possibility they were dealing with. That. There's no question they came into the land right at the right time. Yud Nisan is when the winter flood's already done, which means you're dealing with the greatest stuff in the world is all sitting right there in front of you, right? All the greatest things that are right there. They walked into a land that was already made for them. They didn't have to worry about anything. Everything was just made right in front of them. That's absolutely awesome. That's a huge sign. That should have been unbelievable for them. But the wasps are unbelievable. there were two times that we mentioned these tzira. One is in Parshas Chukas, and mentions over here as well. One defeated Sichon and Ogar, helped them defeat Sichon and Ogar, and then there were swarms that ended up helping over here when they fought against the Canaanim. How did they do it? We have no idea. The Medrash says that they were shooting poison into the people's eyes and causing them to become sterile. That's what the Medrash says regarding this. But in Pasha Pshat, how are hornets helping you? Forget about Midrashic. But they do.
I almost got stung by a hornet. Imagine 1,000.
Yeah, it's just scary that you had that many that were going all at once and all fighting on your side. It's just an unbelievable wonder. Like, it's something to really think about. Like, what in the world?
Why hornets?
Yeah, well, there is a Ben Ish Chai on that. The Ben Ish Chai says, he goes to the Gemara in Bava Kama, Kuf Yud Zayin, and a couple others where it mentions there's a snake surrounding the cave of someone that died. A snake surrounding the... You've ever seen those Gemaras where in Bava Kama, Kuf Yud Zayin, it's also mentioned in Bava Metzia, Pei Dalet, where there was a snake surrounding the cave of the person that died with its tail in its mouth. And the Ben Ish Chai explains what that means is that there's a tremendous Yetzer Hara. There's this crazy, crazy Yetzer Hara. And the Yitzhar that a person has, that Tzaddik has, he subdues it and subjugates it to himself. When he dies, the Yitzhar protects him. And the Yitzhar takes the form of a destroying creature that will protect you no matter what. So the Ben Ish Chai suggests that the hornets over here may have been the neshamos of Klal Yisrael that died in the Midbar, who subjugated, who took down their Yitzhar, and their Yitzhar became hornets to protect their children when they entered Eretz Yisrael. So Ben Ish Chai and Kuf Yud Zayin in Bava Kama. Such an unbelievable idea, though. It really is a strange Gemara. I've never seen anyone else who's ever understood the snake surrounding the caves of the Tzaddikim. I've never understood that at all. But that's
the
one.
The snake is like the bad. So here's the snake that protects you.
Right. Here it's doing something amazing because it's yours. Pasuk Yud Aleph Ata. Look at this word over here. Okay. When we bench, okay, we say Yeruah Sashem Kidoshav. Not Yiru. It's Yeru. That's how you got to pronounce it over here. Yeruah Hashem, fear Hashem, ve'ivdu also besum him, and serve him in purity, ve'emes, and with truth, ve'asirus Elohim asher avdu avoseichem. Remove all the idols that your fathers had served, be'evar anar, and the other side of the Jordan River, of Mitzrayim. Ve'ivdu Hashem, and instead just serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, says Yoshua, v'im rabbe nechem lavdus Hashem, and if it's bad in your eyes to do so, to serve Hashem, bachru lechem ayom es mi savodun. Then you know what? Choose today. Who are you going to serve? Do you want to serve the gods that Terach did all the way on the other side of the Jordan River? Do you want to serve the gods of the Amori that you're living in their land right now? Me and my family, by the way, we're going to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But you guys get to choose. Which one do you want? So the people took that immediately, right? And again, he's trying to reprimand them. He knew that they had kept some of the idols from the spoils of war, claiming that they were going to burn them down, but they didn't burn them down. They used it as artwork, or they tried whatever it is. And he said to them, this is not good. You're being misled by your greed. Things aren't happening. Do you think we would forsake Hashem to serve this? Do you know what we just saw, what we just been through? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out, and our fathers from the land of Mitzrayim, based on it, from the land of slavery. He did in front of our eyes all these crazy signs. He kept us over the roads that we traveled on. And look what he did to all the nations that are around here. Of course we're going to serve Hashem. Of course, that's the idea. There's no way. Yoshua told them, you're not going to be able to serve. Yeah.
These are still the people that were in the Midbar, right?
Yeah, they had been in the Midbar. They didn't necessarily leave Mitzrayim, but they were there.
Yeah, but they still had the Ananiya Kavod and the surrounding them.
Yeah, for sure. They had seen it themselves. They said, there's no way. So they gave. They said, first of all, we're false gods of the nations. Obviously, they're not big. That we're not going to do. And even the Malachim, we know that what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is. We've seen it with our own eyes. And that's where Yoshua got them and said, exactly. The only reason why you guys are finding it easy to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu right now, even though you have idols all around you and you didn't get rid of it, is because you saw it with your own eyes. What about your grandkids? What about your great-grandkids? They didn't see all this. They're not going to see all this. They're not going to have miracles around them at all times. They're not going to see me or Moshe. So what about them? Why are they going to serve Hashem? It's one thing that you're serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu because you remember them on. You remember the Ananei Kavod. What about those people that are never going to see it? Then what are you going to do? Vayom Yoshua La'am. And Pasuk Yates. Lo Suchu Avras Hashem. You're not going to be able to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ki Elohim Kedoshim Hu, he's too holy. El Kanohu, and he's very jealous. Lo Yisil Vishachon L'chatoseichem, he's not going to be able to forgive your tremendous pesha on your chatos. Ki Sazul Hashem, you are going to forsake Hashem. Ba'avaratem Elohim Echor, and you're going to serve these strange gods. The Shav, right? Even if you turn the Heir Lachem, he's going to do evil to you. He's going to destroy you instead of doing good to you. These are really brash words. When we say holiness, we mean you have to stay away from everything. You have to stay away from everything. You have to purify yourselves. You can't just say like, well, yeah, I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing and I'll be okay. You have to do a lot more than that. So, Pasuk Chav Aleph, Vayomer Amal Yoshua, Lo, Ki Es Hashem Navot. No, we're going to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're taking it upon ourselves. We're making a bris right now. Vayomer Yoshua Alam, Eidem Atem Bachem, you are witnesses among yourselves. Ki Atem Bachatem Lecham Es Hashem Navot Oso, that you chose HaKadosh Baruch Hu and you're going to serve him. Vayomeru Eidem. Vato, he said to them now, if you do that, you must remove everything you have in your midst. Wait, the artwork and everything.
What is
the
significance of this agreement here? They already,
100%.
They're still obligated to do all the mitzvahs. So what is the significance of them saying,
So there's three answers to the question. One is, even when they were Mushba Omeh Har Sinai, still Moshe Rabbeinu made a bris with them at the end of his life. Right? He said to them, let's make another bris with the klolos in Parshas Kisavo, and Yoshua is following suit and doing the exact same thing. Saying that's what Moshe Rabbeinu did at the end of his life, so he's like, I'm making another one at the end of my life. Even if it was only 14 years or 28 years later, he's like, we're doing this again. That's number one. He's following Moshe Rabbeinu. Number two, it was straight from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that you have to make another bris. As we said, Perek Chav Dalet may have been a direct sivoy of Hashem that Yoshua had to do this. So it was a direct sivoy that he had to do this over here. And number three, Yoshua is trying to get them to talk about it. Nobody's talking about it. And he's like, this is going to be a problem. So he's speaking to them over and over and having them, are you sure? Are you positive? Not that they really needed to know, but for them to say it out loud and to say it again and again so that they would convince their kids even more so and not just leave it to chance.
If here in this case, and Moshe also did this, like, oh, you guys are going to turn away, you're going to do avodah zarah, you're going to do all these things. I mean, it's basically saying you're not going to have a chance. It's going to be so difficult for you to avoid doing. Like, how could Hashem even punish you if he's making the bar so difficult for them to overcome?
They had a chance. They do have a chance. Get rid of everything right now. If you do it
now, but in the next generation.
No, but that was the point. If you get rid of it now, you'll be fine. But they didn't.
But your children.
No. They'll be fine. Because if you get rid of everything, if you make sure everything's gone, you won't have to worry about anything. But they didn't. They didn't get rid of the nations. They didn't get rid of the Avodah Zarah that they had. They kept it. That was the problem. And they became, as we're going to say, they became, in Shoftim, in the beginning, they became Tzidim Le'enechem. They became thorns in their sides because they couldn't get rid of it. Even though Yoshua told them, if you don't do this, this is going to be the result. Remove it or else. And they still didn't listen. The Hatu is Levav Chamal Hashem. He said, "Okay, Yisrael." That's in Pasuk Chav Gimel. Vayomer Romer Amal Yoshua, Hashem Elokeinu Na'avodu V'Kol Nishma. We're going to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're going to do what His voice says. But look, do you see anywhere where Bnei Yisrael says, "Yes, we'll remove the idols from among us"? Do you see them saying it? Do you see them saying, "You're right, we're going to get rid of all the nations"? No, they're like, "Don't worry about it. We're going to serve God." Each time, look at the wording that they say each time.
So why is Lo Ki Hashem playing along?
What is the wording? Hold on a second. He says, Lo Ki Hashem Navod. Ki Hashem Navod. Their first line was, what was the line over here? Chalilo Namiyazav Hashem Lavod Olim Acherim. Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim, etc. And over here, Elohim Navod B'Kol Nishma. So Yoshua cannot do anything more than what it is. Well, Yoshua told them,
You're on your own.
He can't make that decision. If you want to make the deal, even though you're not doing everything I'm telling you to do, I'm going to make the deal. I'm going to make the deal. But it's a bad deal for Klal Yisrael, but Klal Yisrael agreed that they wanted it, so it's too late. And that's why he called in the leaders to make this decision.
Is it saying they're going to serve Hashem and listen to him?
Mm-hmm.
So why? What's the incentive for them to keep the idol?
Well, the main thing was Avodah Zarah. If you notice, he didn't accept all the other mitzvahs along with this bris. This is not like Kisavo, where it's like you got to do this and that and the other, do it b'simcha, etc. Here he's saying specifically Avodah Zarah is the issue.
Right.
That's what he was telling them about.
I mean, if they're not, let's say, assuming they were being honest by saying we're going to serve Hashem.
Yeah,
and
that they really meant it. Yeah.
Then why wouldn't, what's the point of keeping the idols? What are they gaining from that?
They didn't think it was a problem. They're like, come on, it's not an issue. It's not that it was pointless. It wasn't about Avodah Zarah. It was like, but it's really nice, and I like this stuff. Like, I really like it in my house. I want to show my kids that we took this away from the Amori God, from the Amori people that lived here beforehand. And they probably even used it as an excuse. They just thought it was really nice, and they kept it along. And that was the problem. They kept excusing it one after the other after the other. Would you have a Buddha in your house? A golden Buddha? And keep it in your house? I don't believe in Buddha, but, you know, it looks nice. He's a jolly big fat guy.
I would have a Buddha in my house.
There were some people that would. Some of those people that would. That's these guys. It didn't have to be everybody, but it was a couple guys who were just like, come on, please. I know how to deal with this. Okay, I'm a Western Buddhist.
I once had an Airbnb, and there was a huge Buddha statue.
Oh, Baruch Hashem.
Right there.
Did you serve it?
Was the towers you said that
you did? Oh, the huge Buddha, right. The back one.
It was the towers.
Yeah, the back Winston Towers had a huge Buddha.
In my building, a little Buddha.
That's a great place.
And he used to always rub his belly whenever I
ate. It's majority Jew owned, of course. Vayichos Yoshua bris la'am. Yoshua made a bris with the people. Vayomahu vayasim lo chok u'mishpat b'shcham. They made a chok u'mishpat. It doesn't make a difference. That's it. Like, whatever you're going to do, right over here. Now, there are those that say that they mamash did tshuva. And for the most part, they probably did. But this was definitely a new bris, and this was over here as well. There's a bunch of things over here of what they were upset about. They had confidence in themselves. They knew they were going to be able to do this. They weren't worried about what they were going to do over here. Okay, that's the idea behind it. Let's go on. He wrote it down in a sefer. And he took a huge stone and set it up there under the oak tree by the Mikdash of HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
Wait a second, do you realize what you said here? Mm-hmm. He wrote these words in the Sefer Torah.
Mm-hmm. Whoa, hold on. Yes, yeah, hold on. We're going to come to that in a second. Hey, Eli. But he says, V'yimashu ol hina evan azostia banu le'eda. This is going to be a testimony. Ki yishama is kol imri Hashem. Because this heard all the words of Hashem Asher Divrei Imanu, that Hashem had spoken with us. It will be a witness against you if you betray HaKadosh Baruch over here. Now, hold on a second. What did he write together over here? Where do we write it? First of all, the words of this bris are not written anywhere in the Sefer Torah. So to say it's in the Sefer Torah is already strange, isn't it? How could you say that it's in the Sefer Torah?
That's this.
Well, hold on. Yeah. So when it says Sefer Torah Solokim, right, what is that? It could be it's referring to the last eight psukim of Yoshua. That in the last eight psukim that were written in the Torah itself, it's possible they were written by Yoshua or written with by Moshe Bidema, right, either with tears or in mixed letters, and Yoshua put it together.
This is a
and maybe
Eile, not the last psukim.
It could be that Devarim Eile is not referring to these words, but rather had Devarim Eile that were always meant to be in the Torah that hadn't been put down, the words that needed to be put in, so you put in the Sefer Torah's little game. It's possible. Another answer that's given is that Yoshua wrote not only the eight psukim at the very end of the Torah, but also the cities of Ari Miklat. Back in Pasuk Parak Chavalov, we talked about how Yoshua said, Vayidaber Hashem el Yoshua Lamor, which does not appear anywhere else in Nach, and the only other place we see it by is Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Lamor. It doesn't appear by anyone else. Vayidaber Hashem el Aaron Lamor appears twice. But it doesn't say it by anybody else, and Yoshua says it. It could be that he's the one that put in the halachos of the Ari Miklat into the Sefer Torah, which were not there when Moshe Rabbeinu originally wrote it. That's a possibility. That's a possibility. Now, how could he do that? Again, you're dealing with Yoshua, who had a nevuah as close to Moshe Rabbeinu's as you could possibly get. So to say that he added on psukim to the Torah is not so bad. It's not like Ezra Sofer adding psukim to the Torah. It's Yoshua adding psukim to the Torah. So it's possible that that's what it refers to. And there are Rishonim that say that. So it's able to be go over here. Others say it is Sefer Yoshua. But it says Sefer Torah Solokim. And that's what you're referring to. Yeah. But it says Sefer Torah Solokim. It's Sefer Torah, right? Yoshua has a different status than all the others from the Torah because of his closeness and his proximity to the godless of Moshe Rabbeinu himself. It's possible that had the Jewish people not sinned, like the way the Chazal write it, they would have been given five books of Torah and Yoshua. That Yoshua was still always meant to be a sefer. Like the sefer, though, it's an addendum to the Torah itself. The Nitziv talks about this a little bit, how he calls Yoshua sort of like the Torah Sheba'al Peh to the Torah Shebichtav. Sort of like that. You want to call something like that. But something was there, and therefore it made it different, and therefore he added it to the Sefer Torah. So Kim refers to this, and not referring to anything else.
Meaning he wrote us one scroll with the five, with the, like a sixth book?
I don't think he wrote it. I think he himself separated into a separate scroll, because we hold halachically that wouldn't be kosher for a Sefer
that's
Torah.
Not what we're halachically. Right? Maybe he said
it's possible, though, that he did. It did have a different status, though. It had a different status, and there is something interesting. Again, it is the only Sefer in which we darshan directly from, and we take halachos midoraisa from them regarding Ari Miklat. There are laws of Ari Miklat that are not learned from the Sefer Torah that we take from Yoshua directly, and we call them dioraisas. We call them as if they're equal to anything that's written in the Torah. That is a status, I guess, builder that's a little bit made. What's weird is, after he tells them, don't make idols, is he made a stone monument. That's a weird thing. Now, it could be...
It's like a plain stone, he's putting it... Yaakov did that one.
Very good, that's exactly it. This is the exact same oak tree in Shechem, where Yaakov Vinu had buried the Avodah Zarah of the Shvatim. He did the exact same thing here and put a monument on it saying, we are going to stay away from this. Not that it was like an idol or anything, it was a stone slab that said, stay away from idols. I'm sorry, a marker, right, and that's what it was supposed to be. Now, we just saw this. We saw that the Shvatim, who went over the Jordan River, Gad, Reuven, and Chatzis, Shev, and Manasseh, made their own Mizbeach, right, to put it up there. But it wasn't Mizbeach. It was a sign that we're still part of Klal Yisrael, that people misunderstood it, and they almost said, whatever, Pinchas was able to save them. But at the end of the day, they did that. It could be on that stone, that's where it was engraved, all this, the bris that he had made with Klal Yisrael. Unfortunately, we have no idea where that is nowadays. Whether it existed at the time of Shmuel and Avi when this Sefer was written, I have no idea. But it could be that it refers to right over there. Others say this is all referring to a drush of some sort in the Evan that we have over here, that the Evan Hazos Tiaban Aleda is not a real stone, it refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. That the stone refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Anyway, Vayishalach Yoshua Am Yishlo Nachala. So he took all of them, he brought them all back to their portion. Chazal say over here in the Medrash that they buried the Shvatim at this moment. Until this time, the Shvatim had not been buried. And if you wonder, wait a second, how were they not buried up until this moment? What were they doing up until now? Well, look, if we're dealing with the Shvatim and how big a tzaddikim they were, then the assumption is that they're not going to rot any more than they already had or what they needed to, no matter where they are. If they're full flesh and bone, flesh and blood, like they were when they were alive and they never rotted at all, then they're still going to do that no matter what. So it didn't make a difference when they would bury them. They probably kept it as sort of like a talisman for the Shevet.
There's still halacha to bury as soon as possible, isn't there?
By normal people, it would be in order to them.
Our job is to do what we...
No, but for them to rot. It could be the Shvatim didn't have that status.
It's not an issue of rot or anything. You know, even the biggest tzaddikim, they're supposed to be buried right away. It's not our job to determine who's...
But that's part of it. In Moed Katan, there's a machlokis why we bury the dead. Is it for Kavod HaMeis so quickly? Is it Kavod HaMeis or Kavod of the people that are burying him? There is a big machlokas about that. And even when, in Baba Basra as well, when I go into Yesh Nochlin, etc., there's machlokas on what the status would be if you don't need to, if there is anything, or the proper, let's say a person says, don't bury me for a year. Are you allowed to listen to somebody's stipulation before he died? It's by normal people. I don't know. When it comes to the Shvatim, it's possible.
What's the answer to that question?
We are machmir in almost all of it, if I remember correctly.
Should we bury him or not?
We bury immediately. We bury immediately because we might be forget. Oh, yeah, we go by covet of both, if I remember correctly. Yeah, but again, we're dealing with a medrash that says that they waited to bury. If you would have asked me, I would have said, yeah, they buried him as soon as they came to Eretz Yisrael. But the medrash says they waited until now. So then I would tell you it's likely that would only apply by the Shvatim.
Wouldn't it though make? I would just answer that a simple answer is they needed to conquer the land before they can.
They were done conquering. They were now dividing up the land. So you think that
is that point?
No. But they had just spent 7 years dividing up the land. You'd think they would have buried him 7 years earlier. And if this is the end of Yoshua's life, but again, if this is the end of Yoshua's life, some say that Yoshua was the king of Klal Yisrael for only 14 years. Others say he was 72 when Moshe Rabbeinu died, and he died at 110, which means 14 years of dividing up, he would have been 86. Right. He died at 110.
Right.
So 24 years later is when they went back and buried the dead, 24 years after they divided up the land. Again, you're dealing with, I don't know, because we don't know the age. It does sound weird, doesn't it, that he would have become king, Yoshua would have become king, and Moshe Rabbeinu would have died, and he was 96 years old? Because that's what it sounds like. It sounds like he was only king for 14 years, but he died at 110, which means he became king at 96. That sounds a little strange. Because we all look at Yoshua and we think of a little kid, right? Yoshua led them in the war. 96 years old. Now, granted, things could have been different back then.
The war was like 65 years ago.
No. The war 14 years ago. Because he went to war with Yericho. He went to the Ai.
Yeah, but we also know he went to war with Amalek. So.
Oh, well, for sure. Yeah, that was 40 years ago also. So if you say he was 72, then 40 years ago was 32. Great. 72, I can at least go by. Again, but we don't know. Maybe years were different. Maybe Yoshua had the ability to go a little bit further. Either way, it says, after all this, 110 years old. Baruch Hashem, if we start off the beginning of the Sefer, it said he was Mishares Moshe, and Moshe was the Eved Hashem. We end the Sefer off, and he's an Eved Hashem himself. Yoshua grew to the point where he was an Eved Hashem. Don't say he's a nobody. He 100% grew to be an Eved Hashem. Ben Me'ev Asher Hashem, 110 years old. Ve'ikbru also b'gvul nachlasai. Oh, I should say very quickly. Some say that he lost 10 years of his life. Remember we said before that he was punished for not conquering the land quicker. He was told that you wouldn't die until you conquer the land, until finish conquering the land. So he said, okay, so we'll take our time. And they took their time, and because of that, he lost 10 years of his life from what he was supposed to live. But again, if he was younger, 72, and he got an extra 24 years anyway, it's a little weird. Either way, Vayipru so bigvul nachla, so they buried him in his nachla, b'timnas sarach, in the area called Timnas Sarach, before we called it Timnas Cheras. Here he's called Timnas Sarach over here, right? By his area, Shebahar Ephraim, by the mountains of Ephraim, mitzvon lahar ga'ash, north of the volcano. North of the Har Ga'ash, which is a mountain that quakes. So we do know the area, around the area itself, and I believe they have a mesora where Yoshua is buried. Where he actually is buried. But whether or not it's the actual place or not, I have no idea what the volcano refers to. Chazal say that there was a volcano that shook and rumbled and threatened to erupt on the day of his burial because they didn't give him enough of a eulogy. By Moshe Rabbeinu, they mourned him for 30 days. By Aaron, they mourned him for 30 days. Yoshua, the shiva was up and everybody was like, yeah, let's go home. And they didn't mourn him the way they did by Moshe and Aaron, etc. They buried him quickly and returned to their work. And remember, that was the reason why the Zakenim died early, as we'll talk about in a second. The Zakenim died early because they didn't give him a proper eulogy. Har Goash is a hint to that because there was a volcano that apparently erupted or came close to erupting over here. Why, where that is, I have no idea. I don't know of any volcanoes in Eretz Yisrael, where that would be, especially in the area of Har Ephraim. That'd be an interesting thing to know. What are you going to say? Anywhere north of the Shomron would be Har Ephraim. All of that area would be Har Ephraim, maybe a little bit further out. North of Yerushalayim. North of Yerushalayim and east toward the Jordan River, right? I mean, directly east is still Yehuda, but up north is Binyamin, and then above Binyamin is Ephraim and Menasha right there. Ephraim and the Menasha above that. So the Shomron would be the best way to describe it. Yavod Yisrael is Hashem kol Yehoshua. Bnei Yisrael and Achtos, they all served the Kadosh Baruch Hu all the days of Yoshua. The Chol Yimei Zakenim Asher Harichu Yamim Achar Yoshua, and all the days of the Zakenim that lengthened their days after the days of Yoshua. Asher Yadu Es Kol Maase Hashem Asher Asal Yisrael. They knew the deeds of our Kadosh Baruch Hu that he had done for Bnei Yisrael. Look, they knew what he had done over here, and that's that. It seems two generations. That's how long it took. Two generations before the people started to go astray. It says, Harichu Yamin. It does seem like they only lengthened their days, not years afterward. It seems they died one by one after Yeshua died for not eulogizing him properly, one by one.
Are these the Zakenim from the time of Moshe or the Zakenim of Yeshua's time?
It would be likely that those Zakenim were either dead or that...
Meaning,
there were the Yoshua's elderly Zakenim. Statesmen, you know, Moshe's Zakenim were probably already dead, or elderly statesmen.
Here that
statesmen.
Lived past Yoshua, we're talking about Moshe Zakenim, who managed to live longer than Yoshua,
or Yoshua's. You know, they might have made new Zakenim in the days of Yoshua. I don't know.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, it could be either one. I don't think there's any riot to that right over there. There is one other blame that Yoshua got over here. Yoshua could have davened for Avodah Zarah to be batal completely, and he never did so. For that reason, later on in Navi, in Nehemiah, he's called Yeshua, without a hey. He's missing out.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't like that answer, because why doesn't everybody daven for any Yeshua? Like, there's a reason for that, because there's everything...
You are 100% right. He felt, this is Gemara and Timura, he felt that you shouldn't daven because people should have the choice, the Bechira, and they should try to choose better. Anshei Knesset Gedolah thought that Bnei Yisrael can't handle it anymore, so
right.
They took it away. That's
Gemara
and Timura.
They took it away, but the counter balance of that was there's no more Nebuah.
Right, no more Nebuah,
so,
together with
that,
it.
There'd be no more Nevi'im.
You're right. Yoshua probably felt it wasn't there. And that's why I said, some say that's a little bit of a problem on his part. Some say that's there, but it has to be mentioned. That's something that's out there. The bones of Yosef, the Bnei Yisrael, brought out of Mitzrayim, they buried in Shechem. In the area that Yaakov had bought from Chamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 ksita. Yosef had it as an achla. It's crazy. That land is mamish ours. We mentioned it in the Torah and in Yoshua that we bought it specifically, and yet, unfortunately, it's no longer in our hands. Elazar ben Aaron Mace, and then Elazar ben Aaron died. They buried him in the Giva, the hill of Pinchas, his son, Shanitan Lo Bahar Ephraim, that was given to him on the mountain of Ephraim. Now, here in of itself is a little bit of Akasha. What in the world that was given to him in Har Ephraim? How did Pinchas get land? How did Pinchas, a Kohen, get land? Kohanim can't get land. There's no such thing. So, where did he get the land from? How can it happen?
His wife.
So, very good. One answer is that he got it through his wife. Yeah. One answer is that he got it through his wife, and that would be the easiest answer. That's that he got that. His wife was from the tribe of Ephraim, so he lived in Ephraim,
but
and he ended
Levim
up inheriting
their own
from her.
Midrashim also?
Yeah, but they didn't own it. The ownership
did not go directly
to the Levium.
We talked about how they asked for fields.
They did. They asked for fields to use. Yeah, but it wasn't theirs officially, meaning they couldn't give it to their kids afterward. That wasn't an official inheritance. It belonged to the city, and the people could decide who they wanted to give it to, but it wasn't something that a person could inherit straight to. But there is a second answer. Elazar's wife, the mother of Pinchas, may have been from the tribe of Ephraim, and therefore the inheritance fell to her after her death. Now, that goes with the whole machlokas. Did Elazar marry one of the daughters of Yisro, or did Elazar marry one of the daughters of Yosef, who is Benos Putiel? that we talk about over there, right? When we talk about Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen, right? So he was called Ben Poti Zeh, says Rashi. So he's the daughter of Putiel, who's Putiel from Yosef or from this. That was a question regarding that itself. Another answer is that it could be that Pinchas received a special portion because of the person that he was before the division of the land. That just like Kalev got a portion, Yoshua got a portion, Pinchas himself also got a portion because of how special he was.
Is it possible
that he was given something
Pinchas,
special?
We see that, I think in... there are tribes who just like go to war and like conquer land. For
it could
themselves.
Be Pinchas took it for himself. Yeah, it would have to be before the other people took their land. But yeah, it very well could be. Could be that it happened there as well. Right, that's that. It could be. It's not even really a portion in the area that Pinchas was using because that was given to him as a Kohen. He was given a piece of land. That's where Elazar was buried. Maybe he didn't actually own it.
Bury all the Levim.
Yeah, exactly. They just buried him in that land because that was there. And of course, it could be that it was really Elazar's land. And Elazar, you know, sort of inherited it to Pinchas right as he was dying. So Elazar must have been, maybe that's where he was living, and that's that, right? But that's that. But that's the end of Yoshua, everybody. We have 10 conditions that Yoshua did when you go through Eretz Yisrael. The 10 conditions are the following. Jews are always permitted to allow their animals to graze inside the forest, but only small animals, not big animals. Number 2, everyone is permitted to gather grass and firewood in the fields, but not thorn bushes and not branches that are already broken off or dry branches. It has to be branches that are still attached to trees. You can take twigs from there. Number 3 is that Jews can cut off branches from other trees in order to plant in their own fields or to graft onto their own trees. You're allowed to do that. 4th, water of a spring could be used by anybody, not just the person who owns the land that the water of the spring is on. Number 5 is the Yamei Kinneret. Anybody can fish there, right? Everybody had the right to fish there, but they couldn't drive sticks into the ground and stick nets there. The only people who could do that was Shevet Naphtali. Number 6, if you ever need to go to the washroom, you can go to the washroom by the wall of someone's field. Number 7, the paths that ran through private fields, you were allowed to go. Right, they were open to the public until the heavy winter rains came. From the harvest ended until the heavy winter rains, they would be around there. Number 8, right, if it became rough after the mud had dried and hardened, then the travelers were allowed to walk on it if it was a road that went through certain areas. Number 9, if you got lost in a vineyard, you're allowed to cut your way out, but you might have to pay the owners afterward. Right, you can't damage someone's property, but if you have to, then you're allowed to do it, but you do have to pay for it at the end of the day. Number 10 is the ground on which a person dies ends up becoming yours, and the person is buried there as a mace mitzvah, possibly not even, right? But that tenth is the ground itself. The Gemara mentions there are 4 other things over there in Bava Kamma. You are allowed to pile up manure for it to be stepped on for the next 30 days. You're allowed to do that in the street, which is almost as disgusting as it sounds like.
I understand.
They used to pile up manure, and apparently it was good for the manure to be stepped on quite a bit. So you used to pile it up in the streets, and you were allowed to leave it in the streets for people to go on and for the wagons and for the animals to step on and then use it. You were allowed to pile it up in the street, even though it's whatever. They were allowed to do that. Also with bees, I don't quite get it. The swarming of the bees, you're allowed to go after a swarm. If it goes into a field, you don't have to worry. Number 13 and 14 are technically the same. If you own something that's pretty cheap and the other guy owns something that's very expensive and that guy's thing breaks, you have to pour out your not as expensive thing, catch his really expensive thing and save it, right? And you get paid back for the little, for what you got. But you don't get to keep his, you know, whatever it is. So if you have, like, let's say a jug of honey and the other guy had a barrel of wine, right? Honey is more expensive than wine. So if his barrel breaks, you would have to pour out the wine, catch the honey, and then the guy would pay you for the wine, but not anything more than that. You wouldn't be able to keep the honey. Same thing with wood and flax, etc. Those are the types of things
honey's
that a person would be able to do.
Wine those days?
Apparently, yeah. I don't think
wine was very good back then.
Yeah, but if you buy a bottle of wine, the cheapest bottle of wine is more expensive than a jar of honey.
But maybe by volume. If you had a bottle full of honey, it's way more expensive than wine.
Like, how much is like a thing of honey cost? I think you buy like
$6.
Yeah, I mean,
and not that big. That's like $12.
Yeah, but like decent
and even that
wine
is like
yeah. $40.
Yeah, no, decent wine is $6.99. What do you mean? Nice. Where do you shop? Going around there, I doubt they had decent wine. That's the point. They had the cheap stuff. All right, we have 5 minutes, so we finish Yoshua. Let's just start off with a little bit of an introduction to Shoftim itself. We said over there at the very, very end, of Yoshua, that the Zakenim, who, you know, lived their lives or had long days after Yoshua, that they had died, etc. That's what we had said over here. Now, the amazing part behind it, when it says, there is an opinion that says that the Zakenim refers to all of the Shoftim themselves, meaning the next 400 years of tzaddikim, all the way up until the times of David HaMelech. The Rambam mentions the Shoftim as the Kanim. And that's what we say in Perkei Avos even, right? That Yeshua Masel is Zakenim, Zakenim le-Nevi'im, Levi'im le-Anshe Knesset Gedola, that the Zakenim refers to the Shoftim. That refers to Shoftim. The Rambam even lists the Shoftim in his list of the Mesorah. When he goes through and says who learned from whom, he lists many of the Shoftim. Not all of them, but he lists the Shoftim as part of the Mesorah, as the Zakenim that eventually gave it to the Nevi'im. And who are the Nevi'im? The Nevi'im are the Nevi'im that are the times of the Malachim, like Yeshaya, Yirmiyah, Yechezkel. Those were the later ones, right? Or you go Nassim and Avi, or Gad HaChoizeh, Shmuel and Avi, correct, right, Shmuel and Avi. And the Zakenim actually refers to these. Well, we're going to learn, and there's really good, it's almost like an introduction, the first two prakim of Shoftim, leading up to Parak Gimel, when we finally get into Asniel ben Kenaz and Ehud ben Gera. There's sort of like an introduction going through, with even Pinchas getting involved over here, where it's just like, this is what was happening to the people. Slowly but surely, they were losing it. Slowly but surely, they were losing their religion, their Judaism and everything. And little by little, they had started to follow the ways of the Avodah Zarah because they weren't used to it. They didn't have leaders the way they should have. Either they had died or they weren't as strong. Pinchas was certainly alive.
Kalev still alive?
Kalev was probably still alive for a while. We don't know how long Kalev was alive after this. We have no idea when he died. But Pinchas was certainly alive. That we know for sure because he keeps popping up in the Navi. So we know Pinchas is alive. But Pinchas was a different type of person. Pinchas was a very big into his own hisbodidus. That's part of the reason why Chazal say he was Elio Anavi. Whether he's actually Elio Anavi or he's separate. Elio Anavi was a person who was mekane and went to the side and he did his own thing and had nothing to do with the people. Nothing to do with the people. He didn't want to have anything to do with it. And that's why he became a Navi. Pinchas was very much the same. He wasn't a natural born leader. When he was told to speak to the people, he did. When he was told to do something, he did. But a leader, that wasn't who Pinchas was. He just wasn't that.
Was that his role? He's the Kohen Gadol. His role is his
correct. It could be that that wasn't even. You're right. That wasn't his role. That's what it was. So they didn't have any natural leaders. And by default, it became Asniel ben Kenaz. Asniel ben Kenaz was also a massive Talmid Chacham we already learned about. Couldn't even ask his father-in-law for work or for business. And his wife had to ask for him. His wife goes around, Kalev ben Yefuna. Right, his brother-in-law, his stepbrother, Asniel ben Kenaz and Ehud and Kalev ben Yefuna, Kalev ben Yefuna Hakinizi, he was also the stepson of Kenaz. So we're dealing with a person who is purely into Torah. So what happened to Kalev? He might have been dead. What happened to Pinchas? He was a Hisbodid guy. What happened to Asniel ben Kenaz? Asniel ben Kenaz was the guy who was sitting and learning all day long and had nothing to do with the people. And we have a dearth of information. We don't know who the other people were at the time. Were there other Talmidei Chacham? Of course. Were there other leaders that were available at the time? We don't know of them. And that's what happened. Slowly but surely they lost. And even in Parak Beis, where we see somebody had to go to the people and speak to them, that person who came was Pinchas. Pinchas came to them and gave them Musar, and he's known as a Malach. That's the crazy part. How do you call a human being a Malach itself? How could it be the Malach? And Vayal Malach Hashem mina Gilgol Labochem. Chazal say that refers to Pinchas. It's because Pinchas was a Malach Hashem to the people. He didn't speak to the people. He didn't deal with the people. He wasn't around the people. He just acted like a Malach Hashem. So we're going to go into this. We'll start Shoftim next week.